cultural programming in Portland and all around the state. Visit culturaltrust.org today to learn more before December 31st.
God and do the things, just say it's right.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Rocker T and the 7th Street Band on Saturday, January 6th, beginning at 9 p.m. at Mississippi Studios in Portland. Rocker T is from Brooklyn and has 7 albums released by a number of labels playing reggae and reggaeton. Also performing will be local artist Aaron Nigel Smith, Heavy City, and DJ Kansaman. Again, that's Rocker T and the 7th Street Band on Saturday, January 6th, 9 p.m. at Mississippi Studios, 3939 North Mississippi Avenue in Portland. More information may be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
It's now 10 o'clock. Time for Flashpoints. Be sure and stay tuned because at 11, the Recovery Zone talks to Patrick McDade from People, Places, Things, and the discussion will be about his work in bridging cultural divides. Thanks for tuning in to KBOO, KBOO Portland.
On Flashpoints, we feature two powerful speeches by David K. Johnson, who is the author of What Donald Trump Is Doing to You. And also we're going to hear a reading and a tribute to Eduardo Galeano with Alice Walker, Al Young, and other noted writers celebrating the late and great Eduardo Galeano. All this coming straight ahead on Flashpoints. Stay tuned. You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. Coming up first on Flashpoints, the tribute to Eduardo Galeano. It starts with Aurora Levins Morales, and it's a celebration that includes Alice Walker and other writers paying tribute to this great Central and Latin American writer. Listen to this.
One rainy November dusk, 40 years ago, I came home to a mysterious package sent anonymously from Cuba, containing the 100th issue of Casa de las Américas Journal, and in it discovered Eduardo Galeano's essay, Defense of the Word. I was a 23-year-old poet and had just given my first bookstore reading and had my first poem published. I had been writing poetry since the day I understood the magic of the alphabet, that shapes on a page could transmit meaning across distance. And I had grown up in a family of radicals reading radical poets and storytellers, so I was used to the idea that literature mattered and could serve social justice. But immersed as I was in Latin American music and poetry of resistance, I had never read an essay like that one. Although at 12 I had translated Neruda's Spanish Civil War poem Explico Algunas Cosas, I explain a few things, denouncing the bombardment of Madrid and declaring his vocation as a poet of justice, and read Bertolt Brecht's essay Writing the Truth, Five Difficulties, written during the rise of German fascism, Galeano's essay went far deeper and wider than either, exploring all the contradictory challenges of socially committed writing, arguing both its power and vulnerabilities as a weapon of social change, and it did so in language that sang, rich in emotion and metaphor. The oppressor wants the mirror to give back to the oppressed only a smudge of mercury. What process of change can move a people that does not know who it is or where it comes from? If it does not know who it is, how can it know what it deserves to be? Cannot literature help us directly or indirectly to that revelation? And he goes on to say that that depends on how intensely a writer is bound into the roots, journeys, and aspirations of her people. In an age of alternative facts, fake news, and floods of truthless verbiage streaming on all channels, Galeano's words ring truer than ever. Liberty, he says, in my country, is the name of a jail for political prisoners, and democracy is what various regimes of terror call themselves. The word love defines the relationship of a man with his car, and what is understood by revolution is what a new detergent can do in your kitchen. Glory is something produced by a particular brand of bath soap, and happiness is the sensation of eating sausages. Country at peace means, in many parts of Latin America, cemetery in order. I practically memorized that essay, translated it, quoted it, posted it on my wall, and was inspired not only by its content, but also by the versatility of its form. A collage of numbered sections of poetic prose in impassioned counterpoint, building layers of ever richer argument full of nuance and power. That was the beginning of my love affair with what was then an emerging style of Latin American writing, erupting from the gaps between journalism and poetry, a fierce and lyrical testimonial chorus of defiance and hope. Slowly, he said, a new literature was gathering strength and form in Latin America, a literature that doesn't help others to sleep but keeps us awake, that does not propose to bury our dead but to perpetuate them, that refuses to sweep the ashes and instead tries to light the fire. It continues and enriches a formidable tradition of fighting words. A literature born of the process of crisis and change and deeply involved in the risks and adventures of its time could well help to create the symbols of a new reality. And perhaps, if neither talent nor courage is lacking, may illuminate the road signs. It is not useless to sing the pain and beauty of having been born in America. He ends his essay by saying, if, as we believe, hope is better than nostalgia, then perhaps this nascent literature can come to deserve the beauty of those social forces that sooner or later will radically change the course of our history and perhaps help to guard it for the young. So I dedicate my portion of this reading to the children just now learning the power of their own voices, and if they're lucky and have access to alphabets and books and pencils, are beginning to write, but who one way or another will sing the pain and beauty of the years ahead as together we change their course. Why I write, one. I want to tell you the story of my first real challenge as a storyteller. The first time I feared I might not be up to the task. It occurred in the Bolivian town of Yayagua. I spent some time there near the mine. It was where the San Juan massacre had taken place when the dictator Barrientos ordered his troops to open fire from the heights of the surrounding hills on the drinking, dancing miners celebrating St. John's Eve. I arrived about a year later in 1968 and stayed on for a while thanks to my abilities as an artist. You see, I had always felt an urge to draw, though my sketches never managed to close the gap between myself and the world. The bigger abyss was between my skills and my aspirations, though some of my portraits turned out all right, and I was good at lettering. In Yayagua, I drew portraits of the children of the miners, and I painted posters for the carnival, for public events, whatever was needed. So the town adopted me, and the fact that I had a great time in that miserable frozen world where cold intensifies the poverty. The night of my departure arrived. The miners were my friends, and they gave me a goodbye party with lots of drink. We downed chicha, corn beer, and singani, a sort of tasty but somehow terrible Bolivian grappa. We were celebrating, singing, telling jokes, each worse than the one before. And all the while I knew that at 5 or 6 in the morning, I don't remember which, the siren would blast, summoning them to work in the mine, and there it would all end. We would say goodbye. When the moment approached, they surrounded me as if about to accuse me of something. It wasn't to accuse me of anything, rather to ask, "Now tell us about the sea." I was speechless. The miners were condemned to an early death from silicosis in the bowels of the earth. In those days, life expectancy in the shafts was 30 or 35, no more. They would never visit the sea, would die with no chance of laying eyes on it, were fated by poverty to remain in that stricken little town of Yayagua. My duty was to bring the sea to them and find words capable of soaking them through. That was my first test as a storyteller, and it convinced me that the pursuit is worth something. On another storytelling night, I read to a roomful of Mexican university students. A passage in Voices of Time is about the Spanish poet Federico García Lorca, shot by a firing squad and his works banned during Franco's long dictatorship. It recounts how a troupe from Uruguay dared to put on one of his plays in Madrid, the first after many years of involuntary silence. At the end of the play, the Spanish audience did not applaud. Or better put, they applauded with their feet, stamping on the floor. The actors were stunned. They had no clue what it meant. Had they done such a bad job? Did they deserve such a protest? A long time later in Montevideo, when China Zorrilla, a member of that subversive troupe, told me about it, I thought it couldn't have happened like that. But then it occurred to me that the stamping might have been for the author, executed for being red and gay and peculiar. Maybe it was a way of saying to him, you should know, Federico, just how alive you are. When I retold this story at the university in Mexico, something occurred that had never happened in my many other retellings across Andalusia and elsewhere. The students applauded with their feet, 6,000 feet stamping on the floor with all their heart and soul. They extended both my story and what my story told, as if we were all in a theater in Madrid some years before. The same thundering on the earth, the same way of saying, you should know, Federico, just how alive you are. Silence, please. I learned a lot from the Uruguayan novelist Juan Carlos Onetti when I was starting out. He taught me flat on his back, smoking. He taught me with silence or lies, because he loved to add some luster to the few words he spoke by attributing them to ancient civilizations. On one of those nights of silence and cigarettes and wine that caused instantaneous cirrhosis, the master was lying down, as always, and I was seated by his side. Time passed without us noticing in the least. That was when Onetti told me a Chinese proverb: the only worthwhile words are ones that improve upon silence. I suspect the proverb was not Chinese, but I never forgot it. Neither did I forget what I was told by one of Gandhi's granddaughters, who years later visited Montevideo. We met up at my café, El Brasilero. Recalling her childhood, she told me about her grandfather's word fasts. For one day a week, Gandhi neither listened nor spoke, not at all. The next day, words sounded different. Silence, which speaks without a sound, teaches us to speak. Urraca's allies. In Panama's Veraguas Mountains, Urraca led the indigenous resistance. He received a lot of help from rain, thunder, and wind. Whenever the Spanish conquistadores advanced, rain ruined their powder and muskets. Thunder roared and caused night to descend in the middle of day. The invaders lost their way, and furious winds knocked them to the ground. Tupac Amaru's forebears. Near the middle of the 18th century, Ignacio Torrote led a short-lived rebellion against the intruders who had come to the Peruvian jungle to steal souls and land. At about the same time, Juan Santos Atahualpa's indigenous army was inflicting one crushing defeat after another on the Spanish troops, impeding their advance. And it was not long after Juan Santos lay dying, far from his impenetrable jungle home, that young José Gabriel Condorcanqui took the name Tupac Amaru and rallied the largest indigenous uprising in the history of the Americas. From rebellion to rebellion, defeat to defeat, history rolled on. When she says goodbye, she's really saying, see you later. I'm going to end with this piece, which I want to dedicate to my battered homeland of Puerto Rico, battered by both wind and colonialism. Soil's journey. The black soil of the Amazon is largely made up of biochar, thanks to an ancient yet scorned practice of indigenous farmers in the jungle. Biochar, charcoal made for fertilizer, never decomposes and draws additional sustenance from the 1,001 bits of earthenware that the farmers break apart and then bury to return to the earth what from the earth has come. Thanks to this act of religious gratitude, the soil regenerates continuously from season to season, from hand to hand. Gracias.
Thank you, Aurora, for such a great reading. And thank you all for showing up tonight, taking a break from your busy lives to come by and celebrate and honor, I think, one of the great writers of the 20th century and one of the great writers of our time period. So it's a real privilege and pleasure to share some of Eduardo's work with you. In reading this text many times since, really amazed at the range of his writing, the range of his sensibilities, his insights into the human condition, and his ability to write about just about every topic on Earth and in the solar system and a couple of times in the universe. So it's really incredible what he does in this book. So let me read you a few segments of